We began with impassibility and the relationship of love and pain, and how damaging to the understanding of God it is to assert his impassibility. Yesterday I had the audacity to attempt a mathematical formulation, and I was tempted today to launch into atomic physics, or would it be chemistry? You have seen perhaps those presentations with the atoms bumping into each other, and the ways in which certain atoms then, by some sort of affinity or other, link with one another and become a new thing. That's the way Goethe tended to think about sex and marriage relationships. You have it expounded in his book Die Wahlverwandtschaften, the relatedness which produces the choice. But he was thinking more in a Newtonian sort of way of inevitabilities, laws of nature, and since then there's come a recognition of the random principle, that the way these atoms and molecules and things bounce around has in it an uncertainty factor, and that also renders difficult the formulation of the kind of laws and inevitabilities. A sort of freedom there. However, I resisted the temptation, as is evident from my incompetence in those areas. But there is something there of affinities drawing together and bringing to conjunction, and the creation of a new entity that is perhaps some of the matrix level, of the lower level of things that Lewis talks about. Instead, I laid that aside and thought of our watchword for the day being koinonia. The coin part means what is common. The word koinonia is much used in what Scripture says of the Lord's Supper. It is because the body and blood of Christ are given into you, and into you, and into me, that we are then bodied together. It is that which is common in each of us, what we have shared, what we have had part, what we have had part in, participated in, partaken of, been given to. That third thing, which does not derive from any of us, but being given into each of us, makes us one thing together. The koinonia, the fellowship, the body of Christ. And it is by way of him, and out from him his gifts to us, that make that togetherness that is the koinonia. And the whole point, or not the great thrust in this book of C.S. Lewis is that it is only by that third reference that the togethernesses will hold, will work, and have their happy fruition. that if we try to do it just laterally without reference to him, it won't work. The analogical heresy in the doctrine of the Lord's Supper is its lateral understanding. That is, that it is by our being together and what we do together that makes the Lord's Supper and its koinonia and its fellowship. In the history of theology, the big representative of that is Schleiermacher. It is the Lord's Supper has its way as it is Christ's doing out from him to us, and we, being given his body and blood, are thus related to one another. And the word koinonia in its verbal forms is used interchangeably with the word to receive. The bread which we break, is it not the koinonia of the body of Christ? Is it not our receiving the body of Christ? And in koinonia, then that receiving is something that is common to each of us, for the gift is the common one. And so to friendship, the most appreciative of the loves. With affection, it is by proximity that we sort of rub along with one another and have that kind of comfortable feeling of getting along together, even with the sort of most unlikely people, simply because they are there. We saw the divine aspect of affection in its coming to love what is unlovable at first sight. But that as we rub along together, we come to the growth direction is toward an appreciative love which recognizes what is the particular, the unique, what there is of special gift in each person. And that line of growth of affection brings us into the life of friendship, and that you have had beautifully expounded in the next chapter that is to engage us here. What were the things that you bumped into in this chapter that particularly delighted or enraged or puzzled you?
Right on the first page 55, it says, there are no counterparts to David and Jonathan, I know that, but who's Pylades and Orestes, Roland and Oliver, Amos and Amelie? Maybe you could
help. They're all examples of great friendships, yeah, between people of the same sex, some from mythology, and some from literature. And David and Jonathan.
Who's the Roland with the horn?
That's right.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And who's Amy and Amelia?
That I don't know.
Anybody?
You know, the greatest poem in the world on that is David's poem on the death of Solomon and Jonathan. It's just as fast as anything else, I think.
But do you know who Amy is from Amelia?
Mythology, I would guess. Or Semi.
I have to look it up. Forgive me for not doing my homework properly. Yes.
Well, I was struck by his the point he makes about friendship would be between men or between women, usually, and that how women. In fact, on page 71, he's talked about how women brought into a friendly, a gathering of friends, Stifleus. And he says, the presence of such women, on page 71, thousands strong, helps to account for the modern disparagement of friendship. They're often completely victorious, and so on. And he goes on to talk about how this is done. And he talks about the humor that between the sexes. He says that no one ever really appreciated the other sex, just as no one really appreciates children or animals without at times feeling them to be funny. Humanity is tragic comical, but the division into sexes enables each to see in the other the joke that often escapes into it in itself, and the pathos too. And I was wondering also from this chapter and the next chapter, this was written after his marriage or about the time or before?
I would think before. Do you know, Carol?
It was published in 60, it says, and he died in 64. Or 60, yeah.
But in the chapter on Eros, it seems to me as if he's married.
Yeah. So I think he wrote over a long period of time.
I think he's married when he's talking about Eros. He's talking personally.
This is a copyright by his wife.
But it was published a long time after he put it together, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It seems like this may have been his last work, but that he'd been working on it a long time. I can't remember. It seems like there was a book like that. This may have been it.
A lot of things he's written, he had written essays, and they were separated. He was writing children's works, too, in between, just because he wrote feverishly, and then we come back and finish things. So it's often difficult to date some of those things.
He is rather hard on us, though, isn't he? We ruin friendships.
I think that's very true, though. At a cocktail party, you have to keep it on sort of a lightness way, and if it means that you can't talk seriously. If friends want to get together and talk seriously, whether they're women or men, if you're in a social mixed group, that's not possible. And in that sense, I mean, he's talking about sort of a oneness that friendship permits. In a social situation, the opposite sex blasts it, but you could have a friend of the opposite sex who was a real friend, and then it wouldn't blast it, but then it's not just a social situation, I feel. You can have a real friend from either sex, but it's just an intrusion of the social people.
The criterion is not essentially of sex, but of competence.
Yeah.
And Lewis's own life was lived predominantly in a male world, from his schooling on and into university, and then the life of the college. And it is in that setting that he came to enjoy the friendship that he extols in this chapter. But he recognizes that as socially conditioned, and that it could be in other societies that men and women could enjoy this friendship too, but the enjoyment of the friendship is by the competence of the participants, and the sort of friendships that Lewis delighted in were the friendships of kindred minds. Remember, we began by saying, God says, "Won't you come out and play with me?" And there is the kind of friendship where you find those who respond to that invitation into the sort of game or exercise that you delight in doing together. And so the what's Lewis delights in so much is what he puts under the heading of good talk, pursuing matters with minds trained to pursue a matter with all the back and forth, the cut and thrust, the advance, the retreat, the pushing of the matter forward, that is that kind of when minds come out and play together and pursue a thing. This is one of life's great delights, and they have this thing in common, and in their sharing of it they are knit together. There is that beautiful description of this on page 68. "Those are the golden sessions when four or five of us after a hard day's walking have come to our inn, when our slippers are on, our feet spread out toward the blaze, and our drinks at our elbows, when the whole world and something beyond the world opens itself to our minds, and we talk, and no one has any claim on or any responsibility for another, for they are all free men and equals, as if we had first met an hour ago, while at the same time an affection mellowed by the years enfolds us. Life, natural life, has no better gift to give. Who could have deserved it?" That kind of giftedness and the enjoyment of such hours together. Now, in Lewis's case, it's sort of the minds coming out and playing together in that game of pursuing a question, sharing a matter, a truth, a value, probing, testing, urging, and each alive in that, and from each being evoked the particular contribution and insight of men who are skilled in that kind of game and exercise. And anybody who is incompetent in that game is an outsider. And Lewis not only, as sort of is the pattern through the book, extols the delights of all of that, but then shows how that can go wrong with the sense how this of what we share together and is so much sort of fun and worth in what we share, how that can go wrong in breeding a sense of superiority. We've got this together, and then there's the lesser people who don't have that with us. And that sense of its growing then to a coterie, a clique, a sort of a cabal kind of thing. Us. He's written he's written an essay on this very matter called "The Inner Ring," and the way in which such circles of friends can engender this pride of superiority, of exclusiveness, and of then a looking down on others. But now we have in American society we have had generations of common education of men and women together, and that was not Lewis's experience, and it is his experience out of which he writes. What would we need to say differently from your experience in the American setting, where I suppose in contemporary societies women play a more significant role than in any other?
He needs a lot of descriptive work with male-female friendships, which is a big hang-up in our culture, in our communities, because we don't want to become too close as male and females. After all, there's always the threat of adultery. Mm-hmm. And so males and females don't really become friends, they become acquaintances. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be said. I wish he would have a P.S.
Well, that's what we're supposed to be doing.
You know, he says that a lot of these loves are crossovers. I mean, maybe in his terms of friendship, he's right, but I find limiting, or I don't say, yeah, that's right, when I read when he says that this is the only love that has no need love in it, or that there's no, you know, the sitting around the fire and no sort of responsibility sort of thing in it. You know, I think you can talk to any of your married women friends and they all say, ah, yes, you really need a good friend. Don't all you married women think that you can have a neat marriage, whatever, but you need a good friend?
Oh, yeah.
See, everybody echoes that. Well, that is not this kind, not four or five people rollicking around kind of friendship, but it is, it's a need, if you will. It's a need for a sharing, a person to, or a group of people that you can share your ideas with. And I don't think it's completely lacking in this need thing.
It's the other side of loneliness, isn't it? There's so many people today who are lonely.
Of course, nowadays, as against over some years ago, one places in a marriage, you really place on the marriage partner an awful burden. You say, he has to be my lover, he has to be the father of my kids, he has to be my very best friend. My whole life has to be able to be contained in this two-people relationship, which really isn't perhaps all that realistic. I mean, years ago, we realized you needed a lot of other relationships, and friends can be this.
Containing a relationship sometimes is less healthy than letting one another find another friend. And I feel that in my generation we are less afraid of the adultery idea. I have a lot of good men friends, and I consider them my relationships with them friendships. And yes, it is platonic, and I don't think the other aspect of the relationship has, you know, even occurred to either one of us oftentimes. But I don't know, a lot of times I would prefer a male company over my husband than a female.
Yeah, even though I'm a different generation, I can echo this. I have two very good male friends who have interests that my husband just doesn't have, maybe music, and just compliment the relationship.
Yes, this is exactly sort of bringing it up to where we are, sort of in your generation, and that you have an ease about, you are freer for those kind of friendships than your mother or your grandmother were.
With so much mobility too, we are constantly having to change friends or add new friends, you might say, and then the older friends become less important in your life because they're not near you.
Yes.
So we can't just latch on to one friend and expect to have that one friend all your life in exclusion of other close friends.
Right. Yes.
Here we go.
No, please.
It just seems to me along these lines that, and to give maybe back into what Louis is saying about, like, for example, the same thing like friendship and eros and stuff, where he makes that bridge. It's in the issues the only word I can think of, but intimacy itself. Mm-hmm. That is that a friendship does not bear the burden of a necessary intimacy. Mm-hmm. And I think Louis brings that out very well. I know that's how I also have many good friends. In fact, probably two of my very closest friends in the whole world are men, without the, you know, the whole second stuff. Or and they aren't, I wouldn't precisely call them intimate at all, although there is a great deal of depth and a meeting of that depth. But always, like Louis says, always looking outward, never looking in at each other, but looking forward. I think that's the intimacy thing for me is where Lewis's point turns.
Yes, that's very, this looking at something together, and it is that something which engages you and is the matter or the world that nourishes and is where your friendship goes on. And it's sort of out there, and you're engaged in it together, or it's sort of the ball you toss back and forth to each other, and you are concentrating on the ball for the sake of the good game. And you ruin the game if you stop to stare deep into one another's deep pools. You know, that ruins the game. Now you might want, or you might come to doing some of the deep pools, staring into, or sinking, or drowning into. That's the eros dimension. But I think Lewis helps us to be sensitive to recognizing, sort of alerting us to that may happen. But that's another thing.
That's helpful for me too, because as you read the quote about him sitting around the fire and that and just bossing things around, it seemed I was thinking of a discussion group we had in a church where I was working, and we met once a month and talked about some book that we had agreed together to read and then to get together and discuss. And I remember one session particularly was that kind of thing was happening, where we were really engaged in an intense exchange about this book. And these were people that, in some cases, in some cases I did not see them except for that one session a month. So perhaps the total number of times that I had met some of those people would maybe have been a half a dozen times. And yet, what was happening there was this thing, you know, this thing of friendship, because the sharing was open, And there was risk taking going on, and people were saying things to each other, and I just thought, how could she say that? You know, I mean, I was afraid of a big explosion, but that wasn't happening. You know, it wasn't taken by anyone as a sort of a personal attack, but it was all on this game, you know, this ball game, if you will. It was beautiful, and it was exhilarating. I left that session, walking off the ground, and it didn't have to have a long association with those people to have it.
Something mattered to you all together, and whether it was, you know, six men and five women or 10 women and three men, it didn't make any difference.
It wasn't mixed group,
Yes, Lewis didn't have an awful lot of that kind of experience. His experience of friendship was very much within the male context of his life.
Another thing I don't agree with Lewis is when he says that really there isn't very much sense of responsibility in the kind of friendship that he describes. I think in what I know of friendship, there is a large degree of responsibility. I wonder if this is the difference between men and women. I don't know. I wish some of the older women would speak up about how they consider friendship. I think it might be. I would like to hear.
Well, there's such a thing as what we call women talk, or woman talk, which is just more earthy, because women are more earthy, down to earth, I think. Though they can talk ideas, I know some people will take offense, but we do talk ideas. I have one friend with whom I only talk ideas, and I have other friends with whom I talk about my gripes and frustrations and so forth. But I have noticed that men, or at least my husband, who is so serious with his head, has a friend with whom he plays this ball game eternally, it seems.
You find it a bit boring.
I'm usually included, but sort of to the silent point. I usually do my stitching, you know.
Yes, yes.
So, and it is a game, definitely is.
But there's a responsibility, too, because if one of them lets that ball drop, the other one is left on. There is a responsibility.
No, again, I'm interested in the other women in the room talking about some of the friendships that they've discovered as they've gotten older and older. Because I find friendships deepening as I've gotten older. And I want to know what's ahead.
Well, if I can talk again just a minute, there's sort of an intertwining. And when you have friendships that have gone back over 20 years and you watch the children grow up and all the many things, and you really have kept up a fairly good friendship, but there is a deepening, yes, and there's an intertwining of the best word I could say. There's so many branches. And if, God willing, some of them intermarry the children, well, that's just heaven.
That's the next chapter. How much more wisely we could do for our children than they can do for themselves. The predictably unhappy marriages. But the other, while somebody that's been your friend and you haven't seen for 20 years, you see them again and you're off and away. And there hasn't been any of that sort of responsibility and caring thing. The other side of the world, you bump together and there it goes. And what it goes about may be any sort of thing. It may be woman's talk. It may be the something a shared devotion to baseball. They're into that. He talks about stamp collecting, or it may be how the sharing of recipes, or how do you do that stitch, and the delight in one another's embroidery. The whole range of things, and I suppose. It's again his word about doing it with the light touch, without the clutch or the confinement and the demand on as that the hazard of placing these kinds of demands on marriage. Now, husband and wife have got to be able to do all of these things together. Now, the got to be able to is the antithesis to
what Lewis calls doing it lightly, or we might say with things not getting bogged down with prescriptive insistences at any point, but letting things flow and letting them grow and friendships happening and the destructiveness of their coming under demand, prescriptive demand. You cannot demand of any person that he or she should think the same sort of jokes are funny as you do. You find people like that sometimes. What fun it is! And then you try the same jokes on the next chap or person, and there's no response. The invitation to come out and play doesn't. There isn't a person who hears that invitation at all or is drawn by it. And then at that point, to be thumping them, you've got to. Annihilates the possibility of friendship, and also can be in the kind of demand placed upon spouses that everything in all the world they must be at one together with. Betsy had thought that one of the happiest fruitions of married life would be the sharing of music together. The old man was a dead loss. We tried it for on all three boys. And the come out and play and some of the thumping didn't work. There it is. And she loves us still. But a dimension of her is not brought alive by her husband and children. And there are others who can do that for her. And in that sharing, the friendship thing, a whole range of happy sharing, and that this can be all of that sort of flowing free without the clamping onto that of jealousy, or you mayn't be having that happiness if I can't be in on it too.
I think as a person approaches retirement, and like we are just partially retired, this business of friendships takes on an entirely new dimension, because you have more time for friendships. And I think it's more important then to have different friendships, which mean different things. A friend to go swimming with or to play golf with, or a friend who is professionally interested as you are in a certain study or that sort of thing. A friend from church who has that particular interest. I think a variety of friendships is so much more important as you get older and have more leisure time to spend with those friendships. It would be very easy to get bogged down with just one good friend, and you could suffocate each other.
Yeah. Yes. But putting onto that friend all the expectation of fulfilling the whole range of things.
Well, that wouldn't be fair to you, it wouldn't be fair to them.
Right. And the enormous enrichment, the wealth of our lives in this. And yet, have you ever tried bringing all your friends together?
Oh, yeah.
A disaster, isn't it?
I got one more thing with about Lewis's sense of that, the play and the moment of that, and like Keith was talking about too, when you're talking about the joke. I think the most telling thing about telling somebody else a joke that you shared with another friend is that when the other person doesn't laugh, it's almost always the response of the person that told the joke is, well, you had to be there.
Yeah. And I think that that's a very telling comment about just the nature of what Lewis is talking about in sharing that moment, you know, and how it's, just, you know, sometimes that may never happen again, but there's a real friendship.
Yes.
I don't think you can ever really prescribe what a friendship is going to be, because everybody's different, you know, and just the way you click together. Like, I think somebody was asking people in the room to respond about their friends, you know. I just know, like, one of my really good friends is a woman that, like, we just really hated each other for about 3 months, I remember, and it wasn't a free-flowing friendship, and we didn't sit down and analyze it, but we just really clashed for a time in our lives, you know, and we just wouldn't even talk to each other, but we worked through it, and our really good friends, you know, we were at that time, and I just think a lot of it is, it reminds me in a way of marriage, you know, it's a real commitment. Mm-hmm. To that person, that you have enough respect for each other and enough that you like about each other, that you just, you're willing to work out the differences which are bound to occur.
This is commenting what Betsy said earlier. Mm-hmm. on disagreeing with C.S. Lewis when he says there's a no need. And this is what I found. Isn't this what you said? Mm-hmm. No need. Yeah, this, that there is more than that. There's responsibility with friendship.
Yeah, I'm ironic because I'm not married and I'm not older. I haven't been dead yet.
And you haven't. But you haven't laid an egg either, and you can still tell a good one from a bad one.
I know that, especially now that I'm not pretty much out of my family sphere, that I do rely on my friendships to provide me with almost all the kinds of love that I need, and that friendships do bear that weight of responsibility. Friendships do not collapse when demands are placed on them that are more than the sponge community is demanding. And that's what, you know, not all my friendships do that, but my best friend, and above all my best friend, is a person who exists, who is there not because we enjoy each other all the time, but because there is a commitment and responsibility that's recognized as a friendship that bears more than just what happened. And I don't know, I think Lewis maybe doesn't talk about it. And that is an element of it. Maybe even classical friendship.
Maybe he doesn't even know about that.
Maybe he's saving it for the fourth chapter.
Or perhaps he would say there's another strand coming into play with that.
If he's doing that, then he's playing with words, and he's taking out of friendship something that belongs there.
Without which it couldn't be. Now that's where he would disagree with you, perhaps.
Well, not that all friendships have to have that element, but by saying that when that element enters into friendship, you're bringing in something besides friendship, that's a lie. That's not true.
Why
is
that?
And
I can disagree.
Can you disagree?
I don't know if I disagree, because I think that's what Lewis is saying. Because, you know, at the same time, when you say that a friendship will bear the burdens of these other things and stuff like that, but at the same time, it's not that kind of pressing burden. I'm bringing that intimacy word again. I mean, you can also walk away from that and still retain the gift of that. And I think that's what Lewis is saying. You know, in the moment of the friendship may indeed bear all those things you're talking about, John, and they do. I mean, I know that in my own life. But at the same time, it's, somebody called it once a casual disinterestedness or something like that, but it's that kind of thing. I mean, you can walk away from it without being murdered or murdering the other person, or, you know, it's that kind of a gift. Am I making any sense? Mm-hmm. Not that it doesn't bear the burden, but doesn't do it to the extent that you can't live without that particular person.
I think what he's trying to do in all these loves is to kind of boil them down to what's essential in them. And so that creates a lot of gaps between them, because they do flow together on the edges, and also there are a lot of other things coming in that complicate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like Keith was talking about this group that met together to discuss books, And Lewis, from what I gather from the chapter, would say, well, that's friendship. But then John said, that's not a good friend. That's just a friend. Okay. And it's that difference between a friend and a good friend that's what we're talking about.
A good friend and the best friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That brings in some other layers, like maybe some affection and some other things that develop along the way, and not just an interest, like a society has an interest in one particular thing, such as music.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're not just playing your violin together, it's after you've finished playing your violin and you find out you have some other things to talk about too. That's a good friend.
Oh, well, he says on page 66, the mark of perfect friendship is not that help will be given when the pinch comes. Of course it will. But that having been given, it makes no difference at all. It was a distraction and anomaly. Perhaps it was a horrible waste of time. Perhaps we had only a couple of hours in which to talk, and God bless us, 20 minutes of it had to be devoted to affairs. But I think he does there include, of course, a friend is there to help.
Yes.
But it isn't the main business. I mean, your friends for other reasons first.
You will, of course, pitch in to see that your friend's kids are taken care of, if they have to be taken care of. So you'll do all of that. Of course you'll do all of that. But then what's the real alive thing that is the delight with you and that person is this friendship sharing thing. And sort of strands and layers. And is it not the case that some of one's friends... one knows to be quite untrustworthy, doubtful characters, irresponsible people. We faced this question when we looked for godparents for our children. Who were the people that you could rely on to be there for your kids if you wouldn't any longer be there to care for them? And the choice didn't fall on this kind of friend. But utterly reliable Christian people whom you knew you could count on to be there to do whatever your kids needed to have done for them. Some of your friends, well, he talks about, of course they would, but we know some of them wouldn't. Some of the people that we have great delight in friendship with are pretty dubious characters.
Precisely this friend of my husband's with whom we have these delightful conversations. God forbid if we have to rely on him for anything.
But there's a real value in friendship in sharing an interest. You share something and then it increases in value. And the more things, more interest that one has to share, the more friends you're going to have.
Yeah.
Now I have some friends that, well, our main interest is in birding, for instance. And another is, our main interest is in a certain type of poetry. And we grow in these different areas. And our lives are enriched. And this doesn't mean that they are closed to other friendships. And one of the grand things that I have found about retirement years is it has given me time to join tour groups, like I have joined, and they are all with Hospitality House I have found the Minnesota Historical Society. It's wonderful tours. And I recently took a tour to England and met an entirely different group of people. And we shared so many interests. Our main interest there was in that part of England where the Arthurian legends originated. And visiting the old places there. But that's a different kind of friendship, because there was enrichment and we shared things, and I know that there are people there with whom I could take a tour to any other place, because there's a certain type of thing that we enjoy sharing. We don't keep it to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the more you share, the gift becomes wider. You give it away, and yet their experiences come back into your life.
Yeah.
And I just love to have a variety of friends and a variety of interests.
Yeah.
And I just hope that I can be able to continue them and share them and enrich my life and hopefully enrich other people's lives.
Yes.
I think she hit a terrific thing, and did Doris and everybody, is time. You know, I think in a society when, say, more women were at home, and, you know, they have other friends over for coffee, and there's more of this time, that women were more fortunate, in a sense, than men, who went to work and came back, and they just came back into their families. Women had more free time at church or at home to explore these various possibilities and relationships for friendships. And now Lewis can do it as a college, because that's the sort of thing. But I think men have been sort of cheated in our society in that they don't have as much free time either away from the job or their families as women have had.
But you know, it does take time. I couldn't do many things that I enjoy doing now. Just for years and years and years I was working. But I enjoyed my work. And I have close friends among those people with whom I was working. That's a different kind of a friendship. I enjoy it greatly. I wouldn't give up any of them. Just, I have such a memory book of friends and of interest.
See, you're saying, you know, too, that an enrichment comes. And then when Kathleen was talking about the person who their first meetings were clashes. And, you know, when you say, boy, I'm never going to be, you know, we'll never be friends. I mean, you may don't say it, but you just know that you're not going to be, and yet they finally did. And also hearing the talk about commitment. That's what I said when I said I thought maybe he was saving it for the fourth chapter, because it's going to talk about the, God love, agape, right? And I think within that, if we're living in that, friends are going to come in areas that we wouldn't have chosen. And yet the enrichment is going to be tremendous, maybe in part because that's a spot where we need it the most. I may already know a lot about some particular area and pick friends from there all the time, but I may not need that as much as somebody else who, when I first meet them, I just can't stand them, you know. And yet somehow God is going to provide me with a friend that I really need there. And then, you know, the two strands are coming together, the two kinds, two things are happening.
Well, I think it brings out the old adage that opposites attract. You enjoy people who are different from you because they add a new dimension to your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the differences, you become good friends because you feel you are gaining that extra something from them that you didn't have, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. My heels again.
I wonder if I could just share this. I haven't read the book, but something that's been very meaningful to many of us from Minneapolis and other cities in the United States is the women's, I shouldn't say women's, it's a Bible study fellowship, which has become national. In Minneapolis, we have about five such groups, and in our group, there were 450 women with about 150 on the waiting list. And the mothers, I mean, it's for all ages, senior citizens, housewives, singles, whatever it might be. And we gather every Tuesday, we gather together. It's a 5-year course. And we gathered together and had our Bible study. We had home lessons that took you really into the Bible study. And the only textbook you could use was the Bible. You couldn't use any commentaries. There were Catholics, there were Protestants, there was Jews, we were all together. And it was just a beautiful thing. We have, and now the men have organized it, 2 in the evening, the professional men. And then once a month, we divide into discussion groups, about 15, 17, 20 in the discussion group. And we have a leader. We discuss our lessons that we, and we share the things that we've found in that Bible reading. Then once a month, we have a luncheon meeting where we meet in a home. That's why they're small groups, so we can do that. We bring our sandwich, and the hostess will furnish some little thing to go with it. Then that's sharing time, and you can really express yourself a little bit more. And it's been such a close fellowship. And also there's a prayer chain. And so as soon as somebody had some burden, probably an accident in the family, something happened that you'd telephone two more and so forth, in probably 10 minutes you'd have this chain praying for your special subject, and there'd been some beautiful answers to it. And now as a result, we go shopping in a Super Value store, we go on a vacation up in the North Shore, hi, and you have this bond of fellowship and relationship, and some are young and some are old, and it's just a beautiful thing. And if it comes to your city, by all means, we recommend it. It's just a wonderful thing.
Yeah. You're drawn in, sort of out of yourselves into something more. One of the divine quality of friendship is that unself-regarding quality, that you forget about yourself as you get into this together. And then after it's all over, you might say, wasn't that great? But you couldn't set out by saying, we're going to have a great time, or he's going to be my friend. It happens, and you are pulled out of yourself, and the more completely you are pulled out of yourself, that's a kind of index of the sort of the quality of friendship that it is. And then when we are living outside ourselves, then we are always more living than if we come back home and think that this is where life goes on. Luther's word about the Christian never lives inside himself, he lives in Christ by faith and his neighbor by love, out there, and this come out and play thing. One final thing. Think about the way in which this whole book and Lewis's approach might be tested by putting the discussion into terms of the first article of the Creed, the article of creation, that set of gifts which is in each person, and the potential of those gifts, and his presentation of their going wrong in toward idolatry or to debunking, to scorn, letting each of those gifts be the gifts that they are and not demanding gifts that aren't there. All of that of the bounty of Creator God that is put sort of into the skin of each one of us, and then that all of that is redeemed, that we live with all of that out of the resources of the second article of forgiveness, of acceptance, of knowing ourselves to be loved with a love that was there for us, and we then there for one another in that whole range of gifts that are there, never a whole set, and some of them badly damaged and perverted perhaps, but that are there in every person or everything that we meet, out from the bountiful hand of Creator God. Tomorrow we'll complete love tomorrow.